We're going to learn today a tshuva of the Rivash, Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Sheshes. After the Rashba, the Rush, and the Truma Tzedeshin, he's probably the most widely quoted and most influential that I can think of offhand of the tshuvas of the Rishonim. Yitzchak Bar Sheshes was a North African Rav of the 14th century. I forgot to check exactly what country, whatever territory he lived in would have been today, but you know, the Svardic communities. The Svardic communities of North Africa, he was a colleague, sometimes a sparring partner of the Tashbats, Rabbi Shimon ben Tzemach Duran, and he has several hundred tshuvas, commonly quoted by the Beis Yosef, major influence on the halacha. So this is the first tshuva in our series that we're going to be doing that is not strictly what we would call a halachic tshuva. It is more of an agadic tshuva, a tshuva on philosophy, theology, machshavas Yisrael, hashkafa, whatever you want to call it. Some posts didn't do much of that. The tshuvas to Rosh, you're not going to find too many of those, for example, but some did. You know, the Rashba, the Rivash, do have a handful of tshuvas. It's a relatively tiny minority of their overall collection, but they do have a number of interesting tshuvas. Some of them are just innocuous things like, can you explain to me the meaning of this Gemara? Sometimes even an Agada Gemara, and sometimes a much more heavily fraught and theologically momentous tshuvas. And this tshuva of the Rivash in particular, Simon Mem Hei, is a very, very important tshuva. It's actually quoted by the Ramah, Dark Emotion, Ramah and Yardaya. And it's a combination, I think we'll see, a combination of the importance of the topic, the fact that he represents what I think is largely as close to the center consensus position as you'll find on the issue. He says it eloquently, an interesting tshuva, and is quite a seminal tshuva. The basic question is a Hanukkah-related question. The question was, the Gemara in several places talks about Chachma Yevanis, Greek wisdom of the Greeks, and the Gemara is not too keen about it. The Gemara says it was actually a ban placed on it. So they asked the Rivash, what is Chachma Yevanis? What is meant by the Talmudic phrase Chachma Yevanis that we're supposed to stay away from? Does it mean Greek philosophy, which is basically science and philosophy of the time, physics and metaphysics, as they used to call it? Is that what's meant? Are we allowed to learn philosophy? Explain to us, please. They asked the Rivash, what is meant by the Talmudic phrase Chachma Yevanis? So there are a handful of places in Shas that discuss Chachma Yevanis. There are at least three Gemaras which overlap at least partially. They bring the same basic brisa. There is a Gemara Bava Kamma in Pe Gimel, and in Menachos on Samach Dalet, I think, and Sota on Mem Tes. And in all three of these Gemaras, the Gemara brings a brisa. Tana Rabbanan, it says, Kishiktsaru Malche Beis Chashmonai Zal Zeh. There was a civil war among rival claimants to the throne of Beis Chashmonai, the Chashmonai dynasty. These were famous characters in a terrible civil war. They were brothers, and they were warring against each other. So Hyrcanus was besieging, Aristobulus was inside. Every day, the people inside Aristobulus, they would lower down a basket full of money. The people outside would supply them in exchange for the money, would supply them with animals to offer the carbon tamid, the daily sacrifice. It's important, actually, the term used in the Gemara is Chachmas Yevanis, not Chachma Yevanis. Get to that later. So there was a certain elder who understood this thing called Chachmas Yevanis. So Laz Lahem B'Chachmas Yevanis, he communicated with them using Chachmas Yevanis, using this discipline. Amar Lahen, he told them, Kolzman She'oskim Ba'avoda Einim Sarim B'Yedchem. He gave a critical message to the besiegers. He told them, as long as they do the temple worship, you will never be victorious. They will never be given into your hands. L'machar, they took this advice to heart. L'machar, the next day, shul shulahem dinarim b'kupa v'elam chazir. Instead, they sent him back a pig. No more carbon tamid, etc., etc. And the Gemara says, so in reaction to this terrible affair, the rabbi said, Amru, They made three gzeris, three takanas. Arur adam shigadol chazirim, cursed is he who raises swine. Arur adam shilamed levrao chachmas yivanis, cursed is he who teaches his son chachmas yivanis. These two gzeris, chazirim and chachmas yivanis. Question is, what is chachmas yivanis? So, I was reading a long article on this by Elio Krakowski. He has a very, very long article quoting a lot of academic literature, quoting all the traditional sources. I'm trying to understand, what is Chachmas Yivanis? On the one hand, in much of the literature, particularly the later polemical literature, Chachmas Yivanis was identified with the study of philosophy, the wisdom of the Greeks. At that time, the Greeks were in the Western world, the Greeks, of course, were the gold standard of wisdom. In the medieval scholastic period, they were all studying the Greeks. They were writing commentaries on the Greeks, super commentaries on other commentaries of the Greeks. Aristotle was referred to by the Jewish philosophers, by everyone, as Hapilosof, the philosopher. He was considered the pinnacle of philosophical thought. Back then, of course, science and philosophy were all interwoven. Aristotle wrote physics and metaphysics, which were, philosophy was considered just in a continuum, the next step after science. So Greek wisdom, which was pretty much synonymous with naturalistic, scientific, rationalist study of the world, that was what many Jewish writers understood to be Chachmas Yivanis. In the various battles over the study of philosophy, they would frequently refer to it as Chachmas Yivanis. But it's hard to know how seriously to take that, because, as Krakowski points out, they often were using that in poetry, in kind of verse diatribes against their opponents. And they weren't really writing careful commentaries on the Talmud. So in terms of as we're going to discuss soon, the question is, what is the simple, basic pshat in this text? What is the Chachmas Yivanis? And as the Rav Ashi is going to point out, from context of this Gemara, it doesn't sound like it was philosophy. It sounds like there was a Zakein who communicated with somebody using Chachmas Yivanis, and that led to this tragedy. It doesn't sound like this story has anything to do with philosophy. So that was the question they asked the Rav Ashi. What is Chachmas Yivanis that we need to stay away from? What is meant by this Talmudic passage? So the Rav Ashi brings several sources that he says it does not mean philosophy. Now, the Rav Ashi is going to be opposed to philosophy. That's going to be the second half of the Tshuva. But the Rav Ashi begins by saying that the phrase Chachmas Yivanis in this context does not mean philosophy. Rather, it refers to an elusive means of communication, elusive with an A, a way of saying things without saying exactly what you mean. I guess that was important because it sounds like the Zakein was inside and he was communicating with the enemy. He was parleying with the foes and giving them critical, basically he was betraying the city, betraying the temple. So he couldn't, whatever he wanted to say, he couldn't say it with a megaphone. He couldn't yell it, shout it from the rooftops. So we use Chachmas Yivanis, which is this kind of sly, roundabout way of expressing yourself to communicate secretly with the enemy. And as Rav Ashi points out, this is actually what Rashi says. Rashi says, what is Chachmas Yivanis? Lashon Chachma Shemedabrin Bo Bnei Paltin. It's a kind of sophisticated, sparkling, intelligent way of talking that's spoken by the members of the palace household. Bein Shara Makirin Bo, it's an elite way of speaking. Ordinary people, the plebes, don't understand it. This way, I guess, in front of soldiers, he can whisper his Chachmas Yivanis things. No one will know what he's talking about, and he'll get away with his treason. Elsewhere, Rashi says it was Remizos, one of the other versions of this Gemara. Menachos, I think, he says it was Remizos, which the Rav Ashi suggests means didn't even use verbal speech, involved gesticulations. Keep thinking of Navajo code talkers or something, ways of communicating using exotic and esoteric languages that ordinary people don't understand. Whatever it was, this is the pshat of Rashi and maybe other Rishonim. They bring a handful of other Rishonim who seem to learn this way. Chachmas Yivanis, in context, refers to this way of opaque, kind of impenetrable speech to communicate, or even non-verbal speech to communicate information without it being understandable by other people who might be listening.
What do these gezeiros have to do with what happened? seems like raising pigs. I mean, what does raising pigs have to do with
So it is true that the tragedy was underscored when instead of sending back a sheep for the tumah, they sent back a pig. Although you're right, the fact they didn't send back the sheep was the problem. Whether they sent back a pig or nothing, or even the collected works of Shakespeare, wouldn't really have mattered. The point is they weren't sending sheep. So the pig does seem to be a little bit of an indirect reaction to the tragedy. Chachmas Yevanos, on this understanding, makes a little more sense. So because he was able to communicate using this mischievous way of talking, you're right. I mean,
obviously, you know, if you're doing a... If you're Jews, try to...
Right.
You know, it could be good for you.
It's like we always say in the modern era, tools and language and technologies by their nature are typically dual use, so they can be misused.
I mean, isn't Gemara full of Jews trying to evade the Romans in the various mischievous
right.
ways?
So this is true. So right. Why they picked on these tools specifically?
Our story doesn't make much sense, right? I mean, what is the need for this... subtle transfer of information? He's just giving him advice. I mean,
well, presumably, I always understood the story to mean that the Zaken Echad was on the inside. He was for some reason betraying the city.
Oh,
the Talmud doesn't say exactly where the Zaken. Right, Rashi says Zaken Echad was befnim.
Oh,
he was essentially committing treason, and treason is always best committed.
That's very clever of Rashi, because he's addressing the question which wasn't asked.
I suppose, yeah. The next Rashi also says, La'az lahem, la'osen shebachut. Because he was communicating across enemy lines, he had to... Right, I guess he's kind of... That's Rashi's point there, right? So, yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, I don't really have a real answer to your question, which is that they seem to be kind of treating the symptoms or kind of... We find this in other places, because Al made different xeris to kind of underscore their being upset at a certain situation, even though it doesn't really address the root cause of the problem, which is people who are...
Not only that, I mean the pig thing, I don't know, that's... What's wrong with communicating by code?
I hear that. The thing about dual use, the Rav Ash himself acknowledges that. He goes on in the Tshuva and he says, one of the Gemara says that they, even though they banned Chachmas Yevanos, they permitted it for... The Gemara here goes on. The Gemara says, Chachmas Yevanos mi asira. Is it really the case? They prohibited Chachmas Yevanos, but they say... They bring from Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, who said, "Eini ola l'nafshi mikol benos irai elaf yiladu hoi beis abba." In my father's house, in our tribe or clan, whatever it was, I guess we had 1,000 children. Chamesh meos lamdu Torah, 500 of them studied Torah. Chamesh meos lamdu chachma yivanis. 500 were educated primarily instead of Torah, parallel to Torah, with chachmas yivanis. There were only two of us left, but the point is, it says that there were fully half the household of Rav Shimon Gamliel were studying Chachmas Yevanos, maybe even to the exclusion of Torah, or primarily, but it says they certainly studied Chachmas Yevanos. So the Gemara says, Shani shall base Rav Gamliel to Krom L'Malchus Abba. A dispensation was made for them because they were politically connected, which Rav Ash explains to mean people who are engaged in diplomacy and lobbying and negotiation with kings and princes have need for this kind of stuff. They will be discussing top secret, highly confidential diplomatic and political secrets. You need some form of secret communication. So again, it is a dual use technology, but then they didn't want to forbid it totally because it was necessary for some people. But yeah, it's all right. Why they banned it entirely? Just because it was once, in one case, it was misused by a scoundrel, hard.
Seems like a stretch, no?
Yeah, I can't say I really understand the thought process.
His children are learning how to code.
That also seems like a stretch.
Morse code? Are you just learning Morse code?
Yeah, that doesn't seem like a full-time occupation either. Yeah, it seems a little odd that they would have to be doing that instead of Torah. Yeah, I can't say I really understand what was going on here. So that's the first part of the Rav Ashi's Tshuva. The Rav Ashi gives various other examples and various Talmudic passages of the idea of Chachmas Yevanos being used in Talmudic context, or the idea that they used to speak in these kind of riddles or in this kind of very literary, elusive, clever way of speaking. That's Chachmas Yevanos, and that's what the Gemara is talking about. It does not mean philosophy or science. First half of the Tshuva. Then the Rav Ash goes on and says, but to address your core question, you know, you're less interested in understanding what the Gemara means by Chachmas Yevanos, presumably, and you're more interested in knowing what is the attitude of the Talmud or the Torah or the Jewish tradition in general toward the study of Greek wisdom of science and philosophy. So the Rivash says he does not recommend it. He thinks it's a really bad idea. Doesn't flat out say it's usur, but he is strongly against it. The Rivash says that he begins by quoting a couple of earlier tshuvas. He quotes one famous tshuva, which I think we have independent copies of Rav Haigon. The question was asked by Rabbi Shmuel HaNagid, who was himself quite a colorful figure, Rabbi Shmuel HaLevi, who was a political leader, a statesman, soldier, poet, etc. He asked Rav Hai, is it a good idea to study, what do you think about studying wisdom? Exactly what wisdom he had in mind, I'm not sure, but studying non-Torah wisdom, what do you think about such activity? So Rav Hai told him, I don't think it's such a great idea. Basically, Rav Hai says over and over in different words, if you study Torah and occupy yourself with mitzvahs, that will promote good character and lead to knowledge of Torah and fear of heaven and all the personal attributes and accomplishments that we could desire. If, however, you study other wisdoms, that's a dangerous path. It leads to the rejection of the yoke of Torah and the rejection of mitzvahs. It leads to what we would call going off the derech. One example, for some reason, he gives, it leads to people ignoring tefillah. So this is something that we know from the various battles over the study of philosophy that broke out periodically throughout the medieval period. Time of the Rambam, there were one or two. The encyclopedias talk about the Maimonidean controversies in the plural, several of them. One or two when he was alive, subsequent to his death. Another one which Rivash alludes to presently in the early 14th century. Great battle in Provence in Spain. Rashba was the key figure there about the study of philosophy several generations after the Rambam, and so on and so forth. So in the medieval period, one of the, especially in that debate in the early 14th century, 1305, 1306, in that debate, one of the a lot of the key arguments weren't even so much to do with the theological kashrus of these doctrines or not. They had more to do with the outcome, the conclusion that the opponents felt that it was leading to laxity in the observance of mitzvahs, or even completely throwing off the practical Jewish observance. The opponents frequently accused the philosophers of a lot of it had to do with allegory. The philosophers were often accused of allegorizing passages in the Torah, both narrative sections as well as mitzvahs, as well as the commandments. And therefore they said, you don't really have to put on tefillin. The Hashem means that you should keep the truth of Torah close to your heart and so on. And all the mitzvahs are really philosophical allegories, and it's not the practical details that are the real truth. The inner truth is the key thing. And one of the key claims that was often alleged was that their immersing themselves in philosophy was leading to laxity in observance. And at least in that particular fight, I think in general, the defense of the philosophers, at least those who were more or less mainstream Jewish figures, basically was flat-out denial. They said, Chas v'shalom, it isn't true, we take every mitzvah seriously, just because we spend our time delving into deeper philosophical significance of the mitzvahs doesn't mean that in any way we refuse to accept the actual literal truth of the mitzvah and binding nature of the mitzvah, Chas v'shalom, we would never do that. So Rav Haigon already was concerned with that several hundred years earlier. He says, if you get too carried away with philosophy, you're going to come to reject the key practical halacha l'maaseh of the mitzvahs, and tefillah in particular. He says, if you want to find true Torah in Yirat Shamayim, you're going to find it among those who study Torah, not among those who study philosophy. He, therefore, was against the study of philosophy. Then the Rivash brings the Tshuva HaRashba. He quotes one small Tshuva of the Rashba, who makes the same point. Rashba actually has many, many Tshuvas on this topic. Three or four of them are printed in the Tshuva HaRashba itself. There are many more that were printed in the Minchas Kenos by the Tshuvas of him and other of his opponents and allies in this battle, where the Rashba was vehemently opposed to the study of philosophy. As a matter of fact, at the climax of the battle, the Rashba actually was very reluctant to get dragged in. The person who started the whole battle was a zealot on the anti-philosophy side called Rabbi Abba Mari of Lunel, I think. He was very upset with what he saw were the philosophical excesses of the philosophers in Provence, and he tried to arouse opposition on the part of the more traditional Chachamim. in particular the Rashba, he was related to and a friend friendly to, and the Rashba repeatedly, if you read the Minchas Kanaos, repeatedly demurs and tries to avoid getting involved and says they have their own Rabbanim there, and why do they need me in Barcelona? Let them in Provence take care of themselves. I don't want to get involved. Finally, you know, Rabbi Abba Mari pushed and pushed. Eventually, he felt the need to get involved, along with the rest of the rabbinic community of Barcelona. The Rashba kept saying, we don't have that problem here. We don't have all these people studying philosophy here. It's not our issue. It's their issue. Why should we mix in? And so on.
The man with the spouse dying.
Yes, the Katsuanis.
He was also in Provence, I think.
Right.
Rashba was in Barcelona, and it was the same kind of...
Right. Provence was, I'm not an expert on the history. Provence was a hotbed of intellectual ferment. Yeah, it was kind of the border between, you know, the Jews and the Muslim countries, who were often more open to secular culture, with the non-Jewish culture, with the more traditional Jews, the Bali Tosfos, and the Christian countries. A lot of interesting people in Provence, the various cities in Provence. Yeah, that was Perpignan, a lot of the different Lunel and so on. Provence was a very interesting place. A lot of the very traditional of the Chachamim were there, the Ravid, I think, and the Malamar. A lot of the more less traditional figures there. It was a very interesting place, Provence. And so the Rashba, after finally trying to avoid getting involved for a while, the Rashba eventually did weigh in, took a very hard line against philosophy. Well, even then, his opposition was largely practical. They actually issued a cherem in Barcelona against the study of philosophy. I think the cherem was only local to Barcelona, but they actually issued a cherem against studying any discipline other than Torah. But they said the cherem only applies to youths who are under 25, who are mature and haven't learned enough Torah yet to be allowed to study this stuff. And there was an exception made for medicine, which was considered important and necessary and so on. And then the implication is that it wasn't necessarily trafe, but it would be better if it would be studied by people who were more religiously mature and better able to handle the seductive and dangerous wisdoms of the non-Jews. And the people in Provence did not agree. One of their leaders, Rabbi Avram, Rabbi Yediyah Habadarsi, wrote back a massive 22-page letter to the Rashba. It's a great letter to read. He had enormous respect, enormous deference for the Rashba. I mean, he begins every paragraph, every page with all kinds of encomiums and all kinds of praise to the Rashba and how much he respects him. And then he just tries to express his position and why they don't agree, and kind of after the great deference and respect to the Rashba, explains their own position. Years later, centuries later, in the 16th century, the Ramah and the Marshal had a little quarrel about philosophy. They were arguing about something super technical, a question about treifus and animal anatomy. And in one tshuva, the Ramah and the Marshal were also cousins. The Ramah wrote to the Marshal. He wrote, the question was, how to understand a certain anatomical feature or a certain term in the anatomy of animals. And Ramah quoted something from Aristotle as by way of explanation or clarification of some point. Marshall was enraged. Marshall wrote back that the Torah is wearing sackcloth and weeping, that you've brought in its rival into its house. How can you read such things? How can you study such things and introduce them to the Torah and so on? So Ramah fought back and defended himself. He says, first of all, he says, I don't actually study Aristotle. Everything I know about Aristotle I know from the Rambam, from my study of the Maor Nevuchim. And even that, he says, you know, not like I spend a lot of time on that. All week long, I learn Shas and Poskim, which is my basic bread and butter, he says. On Shabbos, where people go out for strolls and recreation, so I take out my Maor Nevuchim and I study some in my spare time, so to speak, my downtime. I study some Maor Nevuchim. But anyway, so when the Marshal said, like, don't you know, didn't you read what the Rashba said, his severe, harsh fulminations against philosophy, so the... Rabbi Yediyah Habadarsi said, well, yeah, well, so the Ramah said, yeah, well, there was an answer. The answer of Rabbi Yediyah Habadarsi, who ably defended the camp of the philosophers against their attacks. So this was an ongoing battle. The Rivash was already after the Rashba. The Rivash brings briefly the Rashba's opposition without getting into all the details of the story and how the whole thing developed, but the Rivash briefly mentions the Rashba's opposition to the study of philosophy. Then the Rivash feels impelled to discuss the question, the elephant in the room, the Rambam. The Rambam obviously studied philosophy. The Rambam wrote about philosophy. The Rambam has an entire work, the Maor Nevuchim, on philosophy, and the philosophical ideas and way of thinking permeate to a greater or lesser degree all his other writings, even the Yad HaZakah, the Pirush HaMishnah, his letters, his essays, his other letters. Then the Rambam was, his thought was clearly, and the Rav Asher acknowledges this, was clearly deeply, heavily influenced by his study of philosophy. And so the Rambam obviously did feel that learning philosophy was a good idea. So the Rav Asher says, Ravag is the next part of the Rivash. Yes, the two people he mentions were the Rambam and the Ravag. Chassid Kresis was roughly a contemporary of the Rivash. They were both mid 14th century. So I think they were even students together. I think they knew each other. I don't know how often he quotes him, but yeah. So the Rias of Albo is the two figures he mentions by name are the Rambam and the Ravag, as we'll discuss momentarily. You can go back, how he's to Rav Sadia Gaon and to Chavos Lavavos to some extent, and there are others, obviously. But the two he brings are the Rambam and the Ralbag. So the Rambam, he makes two points about the Rambam. So first of all, he says, and this is obviously a very controversial claim, but first of all, he claims that, and he's really echoing, I think, comments of the Ramban much earlier, but he says, first of all, the Rambam studied philosophy as a form of kiruv, essentially, that there were people who had been studying philosophy and who were rejecting Torah as being outmoded, and as they thought philosophy was compelling, and therefore they were assuming it could not be reconciled with the Torah, and therefore they chose to reject Torah. Rambam felt the need to explain to these people that no, philosophy can be reconciled with Torah, and he therefore embarked on his monumental project of studying philosophy and harmonizing it with Torah in order to keep these people within the fold. That's one point he makes. He talks about the idea of kind of damash atashiv. He brings the famous story about in the Talmud about Rabbi Meir and Elisha Acher. Rabbi Meir's Rebbe, Elisha, became irreligious, an unbeliever. Rabbi Meir continued to study Torah from him. And they asked him, how can you do that? So he answered, he gave a famous famous allegory. He said, the Gemara says, Rabbi Meir, Rimon Matzah, Tocho Achal, Klipasel Zarek. He found the fruit, the pomegranate. Fruit has all kinds of peels and rinds and stuff that we don't like, but he threw those away and he found the fruit and he managed to separate the good from the bad. So too, Rabbi Meir knew knew what he could study from Acher, what was acceptable, what was not, and he studied Torah from there. Says Rav Ash, the Rambam did something similar. He needed to study philosophy to understand which of it was true and worthy and how it could be reconciled with the Torah, and he did all this, at least in part, in order to engage with those who were committed to philosophy at the expense of the Torah. As I said, the Rav Ash is not the first or the last to say this. The Ramban had earlier said similar things, that the Rambam may not even have meant everything he said. He said it as a form of kiruv, essentially. When I was younger, I used to think that this was not plausible, that the Rambam's thoroughgoing commitment to philosophy makes it sound like he was much more enthusiastic about it than simply studying it as a form of kiruv. Yet the truth is, to be fair, if you read this tshuva of the Rav Ash carefully, the Rav Ash was nobody's fool. The Rav Ash understood the Rambam's thought very, very well. He tosses around brief references. Rav Ash was a lot closer to the period than I was. He probably understood the Rambam a lot better than I did, both in terms of the philosophical zeitgeist of the time, as well as the Rambam's Torah and the Rambam. The Rav Ash is making, I think, a serious position we should take seriously, that at least some of the Rambam's motive may have been to engage other people, which, again, it's hard to accept. He didn't really believe it. He really felt that, it permeates his thoughts so deeply. And as the Rav Ash himself goes on to say, acknowledge, the Rambam said things which are regrettable. He said he got a little too carried away. Once he began engaging with philosophy, he himself was persuaded by some of their conclusions, and he said some things which the Rav Ash feels are excessive. Now, it's kind of bizarre that if we were to start making a list of things the Rambam says that are excessive, we'd probably have a lot, including things he says about Briyas HaOlam and many other things he says in the Mar Nevuchim about divine providence, which are things he says. For example, the Vilna Gaon very, very sharply condemns the Rambam for his rejection of most of the supernatural in the Talmud, and demons and sorcery and divine names. Whole blot and blot of Gemara the Rambam has to learn in very, very non-traditional, sometimes non-persuasive ways. But the Rav Ash can think of two or three examples of things where he thinks the Rambam went too far. and which he mentions very briefly. One of them is the story of the Ben HaTzarfat, the daughter of the woman of Tzarfat, which is a reference to the story in Malachim. Elio, at one point, has lodging, hospitality from the woman of Tzarfat. She has a son. The son dies. Elio brings her back to life. Both Elio and Elisha have stories like this, where they bring the child of a woman whom they want to do a favor for. They bring the child back to life. Elisha was the Ben Ashunamis. Elio was the Ben Tzarfatis. In both cases, the Navi and Malachim describes them as having brought people back to life. So the Rivash says, very briefly, very cryptically, the Rambam says something dubious, something problematic about the Ben Tzarfatis. Now, I spent a few minutes looking. I didn't have as much time as I would have liked. I am not actually familiar with anything the Rambam says about the Ben Tzarfatis. Presumably, what the Rivash is referring to is the idea that the Rambam might deny that Tchias HaMeisim actually occurred. The Navi says Meis, he means he was sick, he was in a coma, he was at death's door, wasn't actually dead. There were Rishonim who learned like that. The Radak, for example, if you look at the Radak is actually a moderate Maimonidean who often follows the Rambam. But on the other hand, the Radak also is very frum and often sides with Chazal against those of the Rishonim who were hyper-rationalists. So in this particular case, as a classic example, the Radak says there are those who say he doesn't name names. There are those who say that the child was not actually dead and does not actually Tchias HaMeisim. Chazal learned he was actually dead, and he sides with Chazal. As he does in many cases where the more philosophically oriented Rishonim diverge from Chazal, for example, on the story of Shaul and the witch at Ein Dar. So the Radak first brings a Gaonic tradition that there's no such thing as necromancy and bring people back from the dead, and the Baal HaSov was a charlatan, and etc. Then he says Chazal learned the stories literally, and he sides with Chazal against the Gaon. But here, the Radak doesn't name any names who said the Ben Tzarfatis did not actually die. He says Yesh Omrim. The Rambam, I spent a while looking. I could not track down any comment that the Rambam says directly about the Ben Tzarfatis. The Rambam, of course, wrote the entire Igeres Tchias HaMeisim to explain and develop his position on Tchias HaMeisim. He insisted that he believes in Tchias HaMeisim. He does say that it is possible that some of the stories in Tanakh of Tchias HaMeisim are not as literal as they sound. The Meisim Yecheskel, some say, occurred only in a dream or a vision of some sort. And as we've seen in the Radak, there are those who learned that Ben Tzarfatis was not actually Tchias HaMeisim. So the Rambam alludes to the possibility that Tchias HaMeisim did not always occur in every story in Tanakh that sounds like it's describing Tchias HaMeisim, but I couldn't find any direct statement referring to the Ben Tzarfatis. In any event, that's one of the Rivash's examples of a controversial Rambam.
Just out of curiosity, is there a similar debate about the examples of death coming back to life in the Gemara?
Yes. So I saw one of the articles I was reading on this in preparation for this talk. I saw they brought Rabbi Avram Ben HaRambam, who makes a general comment like that about the Meisim and the Gemara. He says, well, because I'll talk about Amaran performing Tchias HaMeisim. I forget, I didn't read the quote carefully. I don't know exactly what he says, but he says something like, it is not to be interpreted literally. They didn't actually bring people back from the dead. Blinader, I'll try to track down the exact source and pass it on to you. So another point of another controversial Rambam the Rivash mentions is what he says about the Malachim that appear to Avram. This, as the Rivash points out, this is the subject of a lengthy critique by the Ramban in the beginning of Parshas Vayera. The Rambam says that the whole thing was a vision. It says Vayera Lav Hashem, Veilone Mamre, and then Vayisein Vayar, there were three people. Most Mepharshim learn Vayera Lav Hashem, he had a vision from Hashem. Then he interrupted it, like Rashi says, to go talk to the Malachim and so on. But there were two separate stories. Then he saw three people, and that was the rest of the story. But the Rambam learns it is that Vayera Lav Hashem is a kind of synopsis of the whole story. He had a vision from Hashem. What were the details of the vision? In the vision, he looked up and he saw three people and they came to his house and they told him news and so on. That was all a vision. He didn't actually meet any Malachim in physical form. That's because the Rambam Shita is Malachim are abstract, spiritual, not abstract, but are incorporeal, physical, non-physical spiritual entities that don't take on real form, physical form. Ramban disagrees at length, but this is the position of the Rambam, which the Rivash also is not happy about. You should mention, the Rivash does not mention this, but the Rivash is about to talk about the Ralbag. The Ralbag also adopts the the Aristotelian Maimonidean view that Malachim do not adopt physical form. The Ralbag, however, has a different interpretation of the story in Vayera. He says that they were people. Malachim, Malach can mean Navi. Malach just means messenger. Like the debates in Chazal themselves about Yachas Malachim, were they people or angels? So the Ralbag says the three people who came to Avram were humans. They were like called Malachim because like Malachi was called, the Navi Malachi was called Malachi. Malach Hashem Tzivakosu. Navi is called a Malach. But anyway, so these are the two or three examples of the Rambam's controversial positions that the Rivash ascribes to Rambam. He says, even the Rambam, who on the whole did a good job of learning philosophy and assimilating and reconciling with Torah, a few areas where he got a little too carried away and he said things that are unfortunate. Then he gets to the Ralbag. He says, Gam. He says, the Chacham Rabbi Levi. He says, he wrote a Pirush Noah on, he was a Chacham Gadol, he wrote a Pirush Noah on Tanakh, he says. And he, however, he says, was even more extreme than the Rambam. This is, I think, the most interesting and kind of cogent brief assessment of the Ralbag by any of his contemporaries. People often ask me when they hear something particularly radical or outrageous by the Ralbag, what was the general reaction to the Ralbag? There are all kinds of different quotes of what people said about the Ralbag, the Maral, Messer Yehuda Leon, and other people about what they said about the Ralbag, but at the end of the day, I think the best assessment is the Rivash. He says he was a Chacham Gadol. He followed in the footsteps of the Rambam. He wrote a beautiful Pirush on Tanakh. However, he says he was led even further down the garden path of Greek philosophy. He contradicted the Rambam, meaning he was to the left of the Rambam on a number of issues, and he kind of followed radical rationalist ideas to their logical conclusions, and therefore went even further than the Rambam, and he quotes, he rattles off a string of about a half dozen controversial positions of the Ralbag that even further than the Rambam. One of them is the notorious view of the Ralbag on divine foreknowledge. The Ralbag struggles with the same problem the Rambam has about the apparent inconsistency as they perceived it between divine foreknowledge and free will. The Rambam basically says we can't fully understand it. In the Mar Devuchim, he tries to explain it somewhat. In the Yad, he just says we just can't fully understand it. The Ralbag basically feels that the question is unanswerable, and therefore he is forced to reject the standard notion of absolute divine omniscience. And he says, Kosh Baruch Hu does not have absolute knowledge of the future. He says, and don't tell me that's a defect in God's perfection, he says, since it's logically impossible for him to have foreknowledge of contingent events. There's no pagam in not being logically inconsistent, he says. That was a very radical sheet to the Ralbag, which the Rivash briefly notes here. Here he notes it briefly. I mentioned earlier that the Rivash has a handful of these theological hashkafa kind of tshuvas. He has another tshuva later in the Rivash where someone asked him, please explain to me the position of the Ralbag on divine foreknowledge and how it's different from that of the Ravid, as expressed in the Hasaga on the Rambam. And the Rivash explains, he says, there's a great difference between them. The Ravid essentially believed in divine foreknowledge and explains what he thinks the Ravid is saying. The Ralbag essentially did not believe in absolute divine foreknowledge, and that's tremendously radical view. That's a complete outlier in Jewish thought, and so on. But the Rivash was very well versed in the. I don't know how well he knew the Arabs and how well he knew the Greeks and the Arabs in the original. But he was very well versed in the thought of the Rambam and the Ralbag. Where he rattles off about a half dozen examples of the Ralbag's more problematic ideas. One of them, which I never saw what was so offensive about this, but Maral also has a spectacular diatribe against Ralbag for this. The Ralbag does not believe that the sun stopped for Yeshua at Givon. Even that the sun stopped for Yeshua at Shemesh B'Givon Dome, Yerech, Be'emekai alone, the Ralbag does not believe that the sun stopped. Similarly, there's a pasuk in Malachim in the story of Yeshaya and Chizkiah, where Chizkiah is deathly ill, and Yeshaya tells him if he improves and he agrees to have children, Hashem will heal him. So Chizkiah says, give me a sign. So he says, what kind of sign? So he says, make the sun go back, basically. Tzel Hamalos, make the shadow go back, or the sun go back. The simple reading of the story, as understood by most people, is that most of the commentators is that the sun's direction was actually reversed as an os for Chizkiah. Ralbag rejects both these readings. He says, it didn't happen. And he says there was no tampering with orbital mechanics here. Now, the reason that Rollback says this, the roots for this, for his conviction here, are buried deep in his philosophical ideas about how astronomy works and the agent of God's Malach, or agent responsible for miracles, and where he fits in the hierarchy of the celestial beings and so on. Very much arcane medieval ways of thinking about the nature of the cosmos and the nature of God's system of performing miracles. The point is that Rollback had these deep philosophical convictions about the system by which miracles are performed, and because he was so committed to his philosophical belief system, he was forced to reinterpret the psukim that seemed to indicate that these miracles did occur. And to be fair to the Rollback, when it comes to Shemesh B'Givon Dom, the Rollback points out, in the actual narrative prose account of the battle, what happened was Yeshua's men were battling the enemy, and they had the upper hand, and they wanted a chance to complete the victory, and had the sun gone down, they would have been forced to break off and let the enemy get away and fight another day. So the miracle was that they had an elongated day so they can complete their victory. So there, in the narrative story, it doesn't say anything about the sun, just as they won. In the poem, they sang a kind of Shira, so it says, Shemesh B'Givon Dom, in the poetic kind of non-literal verse account of the story, mentioned Shemesh B'Givon Dom. So Rollback says, if it actually happened literally, the Torah would have mentioned it in the original prose narrative. It doesn't mention it until the poetry. It's just a figure of speech. It means the victory was so rapid and so total that it was as if the sun stood still while they just wiped out the enemy. It doesn't mean it literally happened. So the morale was absolutely furious with Rollback for saying this. The Rollback has what I think is a good candidate for the most magnificent put down in rabbinic polemic about the Rollback in general. He says that the Rollback often, basically, the point he's making is that the Rollback often found himself pushed into a corner and suggests these incredibly forced readings of the biblical text to justify his, you know, to serve his philosophical convictions. So he says about the Rollback that Oso Ha'ish kilkel b'Nevi'im and pogam b'Ksuvim, he distorted the Nevi'im and damaged the Ksuvim, Oso Perushim shel Tohu v'Vohu. And he says it was the great chus of the Nevi'im that stood in their stead, that the positions that he takes are so far out that nobody will take them seriously. If people would take them seriously, that would be terrible indeed. So thank God the Nevi'im were zocha. His perushim should be so preposterous and nobody will take them seriously. But the Rivash uses much more temperate language. He just quotes a few of these as examples of the nature of Olam Haba, the nature of the punishment of evildoers in this world. Doesn't say exactly what he means, just tells you to read the Rollback's Milchamas Hashem, his magnum opus, where you'll see all his philosophical views set forth and organized. So the Rivash says, so the Rambam, despite his good intentions and having a noble project, nevertheless slipped on a few issues and was seduced by the wisdom of the Greeks, and the Rollback went even further, he says, getting back to the question, should we study philosophy, he says, if these two great men, these two people, these magnificent Talmid HaChamim of monumental stature, he says, nevertheless, even they could be seduced by studying Greek wisdom, he says, certainly us, he says, we who compared to them are like babes in the woods. You know, we are spiritually so much less robust than they are, he says. So much less wise or less theologically mature, he says. Certainly, if we were to study philosophy, then we would be we stand an intolerable risk of being deleteriously influenced by it. Therefore, he says the normative view is that of the Haigun and the Rashba, that philosophy is something that we should stay away from. I should mention that there is one other tshuva of the Rivash, where, just to put a little balance into things, the Rivash was also not entirely thrilled with those who studied Kabbalah. Rivash has another tshuva, so they asked him about certain kavanas, or about the spheros, about how to interpret certain philosophical, certain Kabbalistic doctrines. The Rivash is very leery of getting too deeply involved in Kabbalah. He says, Rabbi Shimshon of Kinon, who was apparently renowned as a great Kabbalist, when he prayed, he would pray like a simple child, without any fancy kavanas. Then the Rivash has one of the records, one of the wickedest, one of the wickedest bits of mockery of Kabbalah. He says the whole doctrine of the spheres, of 10 emanations of God, seems to be deeply troubling. It seems to be very tricky to reconcile that with the unity, the fundamental unity of God. And he says the philosophers mock the Kabbalists, and they say the Christians have 3 gods and the Kabbalists have 10. So the successive Mekubalim have tried to explain why what they believe is not fall afoul of Yichud Hashem and so on. And then the Rivash says he had this debate with a Kabbalistic friend of his, a man he says was a great scholar and a very pious man, and a Kabbalist. The Rivash says, I once asked him, he says, you Kabbalists, you have these notion of 10 spheres, like what are you doing? How can you pray to anyone except God? What are these? What's this multiplicity? What are these things you're praying to? So the Kabbalist said, I'll give you an example, he says, I'll give you a simile, he says, let's say you need a favor of the king, and you need justice, you need your case adjudicated. So you tell the king, you ask the king, please instruct your justice minister to mete out some justice to me. Let's say you need some wine, so you ask the king, please instruct your minister, your Saramashkim, your minister of wine, to get me some wine. So too, Hashem has his agents who run the world. We're asking Hashem. Of course, we're asking Hashem. We ask Hashem to direct the appropriate agents to do what we need. Says Rivash, all right, so maybe you can work it out. But Hashem knows how to run his world. Just ask Hashem. Tell Hashem what you want. Let him worry about which of his minions to send it to him. Why do you have to get involved in this, he says. And the Rivash has various other comments about Kabbalistic doctrine, which he shows himself fairly well versed in. But at the end of the day, the Rivash says, it's similar to what he says about philosophy. It's not necessarily that all of philosophy is bad. He says, however, studying it can be a dangerous pursuit. I don't know if he's quite as much opposed to Kabbalah as to philosophy, but he takes a similarly skeptical, negative view to Kabbalah that, as a practical matter, it leads people into very murky, very dangerous theological territory. That he brings the comment from the Ran, who felt that the Ramban had maybe gotten a little carried away in his overly enthusiastic embrace of Kabbalah and integration of it into his Pirush and into his system of Torah. So the Rivash says, maybe it's not, maybe we should stay away from Kabbalah too, and just at the end of the day, the Rivash takes what I think is, obviously there are, Judaism is a big tent, there have been all kinds of interesting thinkers and all kinds of different schools of thought, but the Rivash represents what I think is a very significant, if not even, perhaps even the major trend of thought throughout much or most of mainstream Jewish history, that whatever theoretical value philosophy or Kabbalah might have, the danger or the problematic aspects of its study, philosophy and certainly a philosophy, outweigh the gains, and therefore as a practical matter, like Rav Haigun says, if you want to, practically the safest and most desirable and most the best practices, the best course to take for most people is study Torah, do mitzvahs, have fear of God, and the rest will sort itself out. Whatever philosophy is true or not true, or Kabbalah is true or not true, then not your affair. It's a dangerous path. It has much more, the downside potential is much more significant than the upside. And therefore, as practical guidance, best practices are study Torah, do mitzvahs, that'll lead to character development and Yirat Shamayim. That's what a person should do, and these other disciplines are fraught and dangerous and best avoided.